Welcome to Breaking Down Barriers, a podcast about entrepreneurship-led economic development. Here is your host, David Ponraj, founder and CEO of Economic Impact Catalyst.
Well, welcome, John, to Breaking Down Barriers.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the invitation.
So, for our guest today, we have John Deary, who has a glowing resume of work in entrepreneurship over the last few decades, and I am thrilled to be having this conversation. John was introduced by a good friend of ours, Leslie Smith, and ever since our first conversation, I've been dying to bring John onto our podcast to talk about his work. So John, if you don't mind kind of setting up the stage by talking about your current work and where you're based and some of your organizational's strategy.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it, David. Thanks for the invitation. So I am comparatively new to entrepreneurship and innovation. I spent the vast majority of my career in banking and financial policies. I started my career at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for 10 years and then went to another financial and economic policy group called the Financial Services Forum, which in my 13th or 14th year there, what took me into the detour of entrepreneurship was I was looking for ways to accelerate economic growth and job creation as we came out of the Great Recession, which of course what was a terrible recession, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Washington seemed to be having difficulty accelerating the recovery. 2 years into the recovery, so in 2011, the economy was growing very slowly and unemployment was still north of 9%, 2 years into the recovery, which is astonishing to think about as we sit here at 3.5% unemployment. And so I started following my nose through the research on economic growth and job creation and eventually found my way to entrepreneurship and what both about how important it is to things like innovation, economic growth, and job creation, but also that entrepreneurship in America had been in decline between 1978 and 2020. Of course, this was in 2011, but that decline continued through 2020. I became wildly intrigued about this because if entrepreneurship is critical to things like economic growth and job creation, and if it was in decline, well, that would explain why policymakers in Washington were having problems accelerating the recovery after the Great Recession. So I and another colleague did a summer of roundtables around the country with entrepreneurs, asking them what's in your way. That was a transformative experience for me to learn about their stories and to hear directly from them about the problems, issues, obstacles in their way. I decided to write a book about that experience called Entrepreneurship and the Soul of the American Economy. Actually, that's the subtitle. The main title was Where the Jobs Are. And then as I was finishing that book, it occurred to me there was no organization in Washington, D.C. That was specifically dedicated to working with policymakers about why entrepreneurship, startups are so important to the things that policymakers care about: innovation, economic growth, job creation, opportunity expansion, rising wages, et cetera, that entrepreneurship was in decline and what to do about it from a policy standpoint. So I decided to leave the Financial Services Forum and start that organization. And that's the Center for American Entrepreneurship. And we launched in July of 2017. We've been around, therefore, for almost 7 years. We have succeeded in that time in raising entrepreneurship to the highest levels of policymaking in Washington. We have succeeded in putting entrepreneurship on the map. We have created the House and Senate Entrepreneurship Caucuses, which astonishingly did not exist before CAA launched. And we have, among many other things, but as just a summary, we have participated in or facilitated the introduction of about 20 some odd pieces of innovation and entrepreneurship legislation, the most recent of which was a bill called the Expanding American Entrepreneurship Act, which was introduced on November 17th. So just a couple of months ago. And the point of that act is to expand access to capital for women founders and entrepreneurs of color. The other bill that we were very involved in very recently was the recently passed, at least by the House, Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act, which is important for two reasons. One is it would expand the child tax credit, which is so important for many Americans, including lots of entrepreneurs, especially women entrepreneurs. And then even more importantly, it would restore tax treatment of startups, research and development investments. In other words, first year expensing, the ability to write off in the first year R&D tax investments. That was changed in 2017. And it was that change was implemented in tax year 2022. So last year, 2023 became the first year that it was a real issue. And that is an that less favorable tax treatment of R&D is an existential threat to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of startups across the country. And the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act will restore first year expensing. And we're very pleased to pass the House by a very large bipartisan majority, and it's now in the Senate. So that's a very quick explanation of where we came from and what we do.
Yeah. I have so many follow-on questions, but the first one is, why is this so important to you? What's the driving passion behind why, of the many things you could have done in 2017, this was the most important thing you wanted to work on?
Well, I felt at the time, well, first of all, I'm a policy guy by background and temperament. And so I am afflicted by the need to feel like the work I'm doing is important. You know, I got to get out of bed every morning and feel like, you know, I'm doing something, I'm contributing something important to the country. And this dilemma of following the Great Recession, which the Great Recession was only the most sort of punctuated aspect of this, but the economy had been decelerating in terms of year-over-year growth since the year 2000. So the Great Recession was sort of a spectacular chapter in that long sequence. But the broader problem was that the U.S. economy, in terms of economic growth and job creation, had been slowing down for many years. And this is a big problem for all kinds of reasons. Economic growth is the basic common denominator of economic well-being of our country, of our fellow citizens, of our society. And slower economic growth, slower job creation, less opportunity, you know, these are enormously important issues. And it had been a real puzzle as to why this deceleration was happening. And as I learned more and more and more about the importance of new businesses, startups, to the components and the driving forces of economic growth, job creation, opportunity expansion, I became convinced that the decline that it was, I'd say it like this, it was not a coincidence that at a time when American entrepreneurship was in decline for four decades, economic growth in the United States, job creation in the United States, and opportunity in the United States had also been decelerating. And therefore, in order to get back to the kind of economy that we had for 55 years after World War II, a very healthy, robust economy, growing at 3.5% on a year-over-year basis, on average, year after year for 55 years, with all the implications that has for job creation, opportunity, et cetera. In order to get back to that kind of economy, we needed to turn this four-decade decline in American entrepreneurship around. That became, the more I learned about that, a wildly intriguing challenge. I became convinced that this was one of the most important and fundamental challenges facing the country, and I wanted to be part of that solution.
So I have one question regarding the history of support from the U.S. government. If American entrepreneurship has been on the decline, what role did the government perceive that they played in this, and why, if this is so important, has the government not intervened sooner?
Yes. Well, to answer your first question, your second question first, the knowledge and understanding of the connection between entrepreneurship and these broader economic indicators, economic growth, job creation, is relatively new. The research that revealed all of that began really in right about the time of the Great Recession, 2008, 9, 10, and has been replicated ever since. And so I just happened to get lucky that at the time when I was trying to come up with new ideas as to how to accelerate those things, there was research out there at the time that was new that was indicating this very enticing, very interesting connection between thriving entrepreneurship and things like economic growth and job creation. So, and the reason why we launched CAE, David, it is because policymakers not only didn't understand those connections at the time, they were completely unaware of them. Policymakers tend to be focused on incumbent businesses, either large corporations or existing small businesses. And their understanding of entrepreneurship tends to be synonymous with small business, existing small businesses. They did not understand because nobody had suggested it to them. And we spend a lot of our time making this suggestion and explaining to them the difference between existing small businesses, which are very important for lots of reasons, and new businesses, which are important for similar reasons, but are also important for a lot of other reasons, and because they are new, are exceptionally fragile. And so they deserve, both because of their role in the economy and because of how fragile they are, we are of the view that new businesses, startups, deserve a special focus and understanding and care by policymakers. In terms of the reasons why the decline happened, that was the question that we put to entrepreneurs in the roundtables that I and a colleague did all throughout the summer of 2011. We basically traveled the country, you know, conducting dozens of roundtables and asking entrepreneurs, what's in your way? What are the problems in your way? The answers came back in five categories, essentially, and those categories now comprise CAE's agenda. And they had to do with new ideas. So these are issues pertaining to tech transfer, commercialization problems, R&D policy by the federal government, the fact that R&D investment by the federal government had been in decline since 1962, access to skilled talent. We heard over and over again, we have the jobs and we need to fill them to survive. We can't find enough people who have the skills that we need. And that's ultimately an indictment of our education system. Also, as part of that is our immigration policies. You know, we have these talent needs. We can't find enough folks domestically, and we can't augment those folks with foreign-born talent because our immigration policies are insane. Access to capital, you know, lots and lots of issues associated with access to capital, always a perennial issue for entrepreneurs. And then a whole range of regulatory and tax issues, aspects of the tax code that are either not sufficiently supportive of, or in some cases, you know, hostile to the interest of startups and their investors. So a wide range of issues, lots of individual or sub-issues under each of those five headings. But those five headings, new ideas, capital, talent, a regulation and tax are how we construct CAE's policy agenda.
Talk to me a little bit more about, as we look at the policy changes that you've been advocating for, is there a component that shows economic impact? Because people love to see ROI on investments, right? And it's always looked at as a zero-sum game where you're taking from one budget line item to another. Can you talk about, when you talk to Congress and to the U.S. government, how do you talk about data and impact? Because a lot of our clients are grant funded and they talk about impact all day long. But again, they have to go talk to their organizations about funding entrepreneurship versus a business attraction or retention deal, bringing Amazon HQ2 versus funding the local coffee shop. Talk to us about like this ROI for investments.
Well, the basic explanation that we give them is we explain this connection between thriving entrepreneurship, which has a lot of needs along the lines of the categories of issues that I just talked about, but the connection between thriving entrepreneurship and faster economic growth and faster job creation. Those are things that policymakers understand they tend to think at higher levels and bigger pictures than, I mean, of course, there are budget committees, and budgets is a very important part of policy. But when we talk about them, when we talk to them and we share with them what research has shown, has demonstrated repeatedly, that higher levels of entrepreneurship, higher rates of new business formation, higher rates of survival of new businesses are associated with, in a very strong way, faster rates of economic growth and job creation. Those are the two most basic economic metrics of economic well-being of any society in any nation. And once they are shown and they understand the connection between entrepreneurship and economic growth, and of course the connective tissue there is it, and we know this from the great work of American economist Robert Solow, who actually just passed away in December at the age of 99. He spent many years from the late 40s right up through the time of his death at MIT. But what Robert Solow taught the world is, and he won the Nobel Prize for this insight in 1987, is that economic growth is driven by gains in productivity, driven by innovation. Innovation is the driving force of economic growth. And the great significance of that insight was that Solow didn't just identify the nature of economic growth, he identified the source, because economists have understood for a very long time that most innovation, not all, but most innovation, and especially most really significant innovation, or what you might call transformative or disruptive innovation, comes from startups and entrepreneurs. If you look back over the last several hundred years, the major innovations that have defined the economic landscape over the last several hundred years, going all the way back to the cotton gin and railroads and electrification, all the way up through airplanes and automobiles and refrigeration and air conditioning, and all the way up through, the computer, countless aspects, applications of the internet, all the way up through wireless communication, and currently now with AI. Virtually all of the major innovations that have characterized the economic landscape since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution have come from entrepreneurs and startups. And Solow's great contribution to the understanding of economic growth is that that is the driving force of economic growth. And so that's what, we find that's very compelling for policymakers and inspires them to be very interested in a pro-entrepreneurship, pro-innovation policy agenda.
Yeah, no, I think that is spot on. And I love to hear you say that, because I and our team also constantly talks about this with policymakers or even municipalities and others. And I think it is an important point to make to kind of help advocate. I want to switch focus, John, to our podcast is called Breaking Down Barriers. And one thing that I really try to get our guests to talk about is around the inequitable access, not just to capital, but to resources, to technical assistance, that American prosperity is not equitably distributed.
Yes.
And as entrepreneurship is driving this, entrepreneurship then should also address the inequities in this space. And I know it's a known problem, and I know that a lot of people are working on it, but I also wanted to get your take on it, because along with all the other things that we're doing, policy has such a big role to play in kind of leveling that playing field.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something I agree with you entirely, David. And right from day one, or even prior to day one, we decided as an organization, before we actually launched officially, that addressing the unique barriers and challenges that confront women entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs of color. So essentially the issue that you're talking about, inclusive entrepreneurship, was going to be a central aspect of what we do, for a very simple reason. If you want to turn around a four-decade decline in American entrepreneurship, you need much higher rates of participation by people who historically have not participated, women entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs of color. So we are strongly of the view that American entrepreneurship cannot be a white guy thing. It's got to be an everybody thing. We're also of the view that it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's an American imperative, is the way that we put it. So right from the very beginning, a very important part of our work was focusing on these issues of inclusion and distribution to which you're referring. And I'll give you a couple of specific examples of how we walk the walk. I mentioned a little while earlier that when we launched, there had never been an entrepreneurship caucus in either chamber of Congress. And just very quickly, caucuses are best thought of as clubs in Congress. They're informal groups that members of Congress can join to learn about a particular topic that they're interested in and conduct briefings and hearings and do events, do roundtables. And it's an informal but very important part of the policy making machinery on the Hill. And there are caucuses for everything under the sun. There are hundreds and hundreds of caucuses. There had never been an entrepreneurship caucus in either chamber of Congress when we launched CAE. And that's vivid evidence of the extent to which entrepreneurship was not on the radar screen in Washington. When we established the first caucus, it happened to be the Senate caucus in 2019, we thought it was very important that the leaders, and of course there'd be a Democratic and Republican leader, co-chairs of the caucus, we thought it was very important for both substantive and symbolic or optical reasons that the first ever entrepreneurship caucus in Congress be led by a woman and a person of color. And so we specifically approached Amy Klobuchar, the Democratic senator from Minnesota, and Tim Scott, the Republican senator from South Carolina, the person of color, man of color, to be the co-chairs of the Senate Entrepreneurship Caucus. And we were delighted when we agreed. And we immediately saw the implications of their leadership and the importance of picking a woman and a person of color as co-chairs, because the very first two events that we did, that we arranged at their request with the Senate Entrepreneurship Caucus, were roundtables, first with women entrepreneurs that we flew in from all over the country and did a two-hour roundtable at the Capitol on all of the unique barriers and challenges that they confront as women founders with the Senate Entrepreneurship Caucus. And then we did an identical event with entrepreneurs of color who we flew in from all over the United States and had a similar discussion. And it was out of that conversation with entrepreneurs of color. It won't surprise you that the topic of access to capital came up. Other topics came up as well. All the ones that you mentioned: access to resources, mentoring, procurement opportunities from the federal government, for example. Lots and lots of areas where entrepreneurs or small business people of color are disadvantaged. But the topic that seemed to be at the top of their list and where they talked about the most was access to capital. And in every instance, every type of capital, bank capital, equity capital, venture capital, angel capital, every type of capital, it seemed entrepreneurs of color were at a disadvantage. And I'm sure that your listeners are aware that when it comes to equity capital, and by that I mean venture and angel capital, the distribution of equity capital in this country along gender and racial lines is atrocious. There's no other word for it. About 2% of all equity capital goes to women, and less than 1% goes to entrepreneurs of color. We regard that as being absolutely indefensible, un-American, immoral, and it is among our top objectives. And that's why we're so excited about the Expanding American Entrepreneurship Act. That piece of legislation will amend the Investment Company Act of 1940. There are aspects of that original act, the Investment Company Act, that actually serve to box out or exclude people of color and women from investing in the funds that invest in startups. And as everybody who's in any way involved in American entrepreneurship or investing knows, who gets funded depends a great deal on who is doing the investing. And if you have an investor base characterized overwhelmingly by white men, you have the very, there's nothing wrong with being a white guy. I'm a white guy. But when your investor base is overwhelmingly white men, you have the rather predictable outcome by way of a phenomenon that has been documented in research called homophily, which is a great word, you know, meaning liking of the same. Investors tend to invest in people that look like them, have similar backgrounds as them and life experiences as them, and who are starting companies that they can relate to. It's a documented phenomenon that has been identified and analyzed in research. Therefore, if you want to get more capital to a more diverse group of entrepreneurs, you have to diversify the investor base. You have to get more accredited women investors and investors of color involved in the funds investing in startups. And that's what the Expanding American Entrepreneurship Act would do.
All right. I've got two more questions for you, John. And both of these are, again, questions that I'm passionate about. This next question I'm going to ask you, a lot of people don't talk about this question. So I'm really curious to hear your take. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, in fact, very few leaders that I have been following in entrepreneurship actually talk about the fact that the nature of entrepreneurship is that you are taking a risk. And that's why entrepreneurs want to do this, because there is this high risk, high reward aspect to it. But for a lot of immigrants, new citizens, and other minority communities, entrepreneurship is almost the only way out, because a returning citizen might not be able to even apply for some of these jobs that we can change through policy. But my question is this: we don't talk about the businesses that fail. We only talk about businesses that succeed. And if we're talking really that the end goal is not even entrepreneurship, but American prosperity, why aren't we paying enough attention and time to what happens to ideas that fail and people that fail? Is it because it's non-sexy, that it's not the cool thing? That because there is, and I'm myself a multiple time entrepreneur. And so as an entrepreneur, that is a very important topic to me, that there is a high chance, a 50-50 chance for most businesses that they will not make it. And how do you create that fail safe? How do you create that fail forward? Knowing that a lot of the investments in entrepreneurship is money that is circulated in the economy, that you're not losing out on an investment. And how do you create a pathway for people to be able to then from there not lose their home or not lose or not become poorer in the process of becoming rich or in the process of becoming prosperous?
That is a great question. I need to think more about that, because you're exactly right. We tend to focus on entrepreneurship as a success story and as a wealth creating and job creating enterprise. But you're right. The simple fact of the matter is a third of all new businesses fail by their second year, half by their fifth. It's the nature of entrepreneurship that it's risky. A huge portion of new businesses, every cohort of new businesses, are going to fail. I would say to answer your question, at least part of your question is the way that I'll put it, because I'm going to think more about your question. What can we do for those, sort of the fail-safe expression that you used? But I think the public policy has a huge role to play here, both in terms of, and this is ultimately what CAE is doing. We are working with policymakers to improve the policy environment to maximize the chances of entrepreneurs succeeding. And when I say succeeding, I don't just mean that they survive and grow. I also mean that if they fail, that failing is as easy and as costless as possible, and then getting back up on their feet and starting again if they have another idea, making that restarting process as easy as possible and lowering the cost and barriers to restarting as much as possible. So that can be everything from making bankruptcy law as easy and as costless as possible. Also in terms of access to capital, access to mentorship, so that they can get back on their feet and start again. It also means things like access to affordable healthcare, access to affordable childcare, dealing with record student debt. These are all huge barriers to entrepreneurship that make the entrepreneurship experience risky. It's really risky to leave your corporate job where you're getting your health care, where you might be getting some sort of subsidy for childcare that is paying you a salary that enables you to pay your monthly student debt, that is providing your retirement security. It's very hard to leave that kind of existence, say goodbye to all of that, and strike out on your own to start a business, not have access to corporate-sponsored healthcare, not have access to affordable childcare, to have much greater difficulty in paying student debt, and having no access to retirement security. So we are working on all of those fronts to de-risk, to lower the risks of being an entrepreneur, to make it as easy as possible to start, as costless and as little damaging as possible to fail, and as easy and as cost-free to begin again. So that's the way I would answer that at the moment. Although I think that your question about what more can we do for entrepreneurs who fail so that we insure them or sort of insulate them from economic damage that's going to make them poorer, that is a very intriguing question that I'm going to need to give more thought to.
Thank you. And thank you for addressing that, because, you know, I am helping with the entrepreneurship ecosystem, but I'm also a small business owner. And I get to wear those two hats every day. And that is a very important question, because we entrepreneurs have this existential question they ask themselves every single day, right? And anybody who's been an entrepreneur gets that, like, especially for people of color. Like, I, you know, I immigrated from India. I didn't come with a nest egg or a cushion that I could fall back on. I had to use my own 401k to actually start this business. And you are faced with these existential questions about, hey, you know, am I going to lose my home? Am I going to lose my healthcare? Things like that. And I think that's one of the reasons I think we've seen a dip in entrepreneurship outside, you know, all the other things you mentioned, because it is so much more risky today, John, to start a business than it was 30 years ago. Healthcare is so much more expensive today. There is so many fewer social constructs to help us than it were 30 years ago. So if the risk is magnified and we don't address that head on, everything else we do will be done in a vacuum, because the person who's at the center of it is being disenfranchised because of the risk and the cost of starting. So thank you for addressing that. I want to end by asking one last question to kind of bring this a full circle, which is around American innovation and security and the role that innovation plays in this grand picture, because there's a lot of investments coming on that end with tech hubs and all these other programs, the CHIPS Act. Wondering, how do we bring entrepreneurship to the center of that? Knowing that, yes, you know, we need the university systems, we need the philanthropy, we need the corporate sponsors, we need everybody to play in the sandbox. How do we not forget the entrepreneur as the driving force to national security and innovation as we go about, you know, the next 3 to 5 years, focusing on a lot of the funding coming through those mechanisms?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And that's part of what we say to policymakers all the time, because you're right. There has been, after a multi-decade decline in federal government commitment to innovation funding and research and development, that was very problematic. As a matter of fact, in fiscal year 2019, federal funding of research and development dropped I think it was 0.6% of GDP, and that was the lowest level in 65 years. There had been a long six-decade decline in federal government commitment to American innovation, research, and development. And so that all changed, of course, with the American Rescue Plan, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS and Science Act. I mean, these are enormously large and significant pieces of legislation, the most significant to come down the pike in six decades, commitments by the federal government to innovation. And there's all kinds, you know, there's a tidal wave of money that is coming out of the federal government that is going to finance, you know, over the course of years, American innovation, research and development, tech hubs, all the things that you mentioned. But you're also exactly right that that's not enough. A very, very important part of making sure that that innovation is actually actualized and gets out into the economy and begins to improve lives and raise standards of living and drive economic growth and job creation is the commercialization of all of that innovation. And the people who commercialize innovation are called entrepreneurs. And so it's entrepreneurship goes hand in hand with the National Innovation Strategy characterized by the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act. And there are aspects of those pieces of legislation that are indeed focused on entrepreneurship. But we think there needs to be a sharper focus on entrepreneurship. And that's the reason why we continue to press our case and to pursue our agenda, you know, which is the American Entrepreneurship Agenda, that folks can read about all the details of what we're working on our website, which is startupsusa.org. We continue to press exactly that case, David, with policymakers every day that we're on Capitol Hill. And when we're in, and when we work with aspects of the executive branch, as a matter of the executive branch agencies that we work with are, as you would imagine, the Small Business Administration, the Commerce Department. I was at the White House just yesterday, not just me, you know, but a whole bunch of other people, because there was a presentation by SBA Administrator Guzman and Lael Brainard, the director of the National Economic Council, on everything that the SBA is doing to enhance entrepreneurship and small business. And so the administration, this administration, really does get the importance of entrepreneurship as a counterpart to their policies and the legislation with regard to innovation. And that's fantastic. But we have to hold their feet to the fire. We have to continue to educate them and approach them with specific policy ideas designed to address problems and barriers that entrepreneurs are facing all over the country as they try to launch and grow their businesses.
This has been such a fascinating conversation, and I want to keep going on and on. So, John, we might have to bring you back just to, even because I haven't started going into the stories that you've seen on your roadshows and your roundtables. Because I'm sure there's lots of exciting things that you found just in terms of anecdotal stories of entrepreneurs. So I might have to bring you back or maybe even capture one of your roundtables into a podcast so that we can, you know, offer a sneak peek to our audiences. But I'm so thrilled that to be connected with you and for our audience to be introduced to your work and to be able to follow along and to also reach out to you. What is the best way for our audience to be able to connect with you?
The best way is by way of the website that I just mentioned, startupsusa.org, but also follow us on social media on Twitter or X. We're at startupsusa.org, you know, just like our URL on the web, except without the dot. And we're on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. We post aggressively in terms of our activities and events and policy work. So the website, Twitter, and LinkedIn, I think, are the best ways to follow us. And if anyone would like to get in touch directly, if they have ideas about issues that we ought to be working on or focused on, my email is John, J-O-H-N, at startupsusa.org.
It has been an absolute pleasure, John, to have you today and to listen to just the wealth of knowledge you are and the incredible work you and your organization are doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate the invitation, and thanks for the work that you and your team do.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Breaking Down Barriers, a podcast about entrepreneurship-led economic development. Special thanks to our renowned guests for joining us. You can find show notes, more episodes, send us ideas, and subscribe to our newsletter on our website, economicimpactcatalyst.com. Breaking Down Barriers is a presentation of Economic Impact Catalyst and is edited by Lauren Bernard. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Breaking Down Barriers, available for free wherever you listen to your podcasts.